for the words of introduction and also for the prayer, Brother MC. We are very thankful, Rebecca and I are very thankful for the privilege of being in your area in general. We've been here once before as a couple. Rebecca spent 3 months or so in this area coal portering. That was back before the last flood. We have them frequently nowadays in New Jersey, didn't you know? Our ecclesia and our Thursday night meeting, we just changed a bunch of meetings. Our Thursday night meetings send their greetings. That includes the Shalhous. We bring special greetings from Brother Ken and Sister Virginia Ross, and they've just been through about 2.5 months of terrible experiences physically. We have one couple in our class that are going through some difficulties now, Brother Dick and Sister Beverly. But if you hear these words, don't make any calls. Just send a card or something to the Lallys. It's a lot of stress, but we love them dearly, and we trust the Lord will overrule as best for both of them. It's nice to see you all from Canada and many places around as well. Had an opportunity to see our brother from Wyoming this morning, and we didn't realize who each other were, so we just talked in general about what we were doing. It's just good to see Bayamare sitting in the audience and meeting brethren from South Arizona, almost Mexico, and Sister Kathy. I didn't expect to see Kathy here and other brethren from around. I'm actually taking advantage of this couple of extra minutes, and I'll probably wind up losing time anyway. Why am I speaking to you today? What is today? Today is the day of the Lord. But I want you to remember that it's also the day of the Lord's wrath. And it's also, as you can see by the title, the day of the travail of Jacob, which we hope to develop in more detail. Now, some of you were at Salem when we put the first notes of this together. And since then, it had its expansion till we got to Antioch. And after that, it got expanded again. And I don't know what the status of it was when we were in Antioch, because my memory is a thing of the past. And, yeah, isn't that funny? But we are thankful to be here, and also thankful that the Lord has granted mercy to us to know a little bit about his plan ahead of the world. And we wait with longing for the day when the world of mankind will grasp the real true meaning and the delight of the Lord that he's going to have in all his children as they come to not only appreciate his will and love his will and love his law, but do it as well, to do it as well. Okay, Israel's travail of trouble. It's interesting in today's news to hear the different ways in which this world perceives the people of Israel, whether it's the individual people who are living in Israel, whether it's the Jewish people. This intelligence forum, intelligence IQ or 2Q or whatever it is on the internet and in these meetings, they just had a discussion. Can Israel live, or Israel can, they had a debate. Israel can live with a nuclear Iran. It could also die with a nuclear Iran. But that debate actually was won by the people who said it can't be. Now, that's an interesting debate system that they have. Why am I mentioning that? Because there has been a lot of saber rattling, we'll call it, or nuclear rattling, whatever you want to call that. The region that they live in is a rough neighborhood, simply and plainly. And then you have people around the world with their boycott, divest, or sanctions attitude, the BDS. Boycott, divest your interest in Israel, or impose sanctions. You also have the intifadas, the Oslo Intifada, by the way. Recently, Arafat's widow said that as soon as he came back from signing the paper, shaking hands in Washington, he told her, I'm going to start an intifada. It was as simple as that. They just made peace, quote-unquote, shaking hands and everything at the White House. And he came up, said, I'm going to start an intifada. Boom. And that's what he did. Thousands of people, I would say, over Well, I'm not going to guess. Thousands of people suffered as a result of that. On both sides of that fence, we have to remember that the people who are part of that organization that became a state, quasi-state in the minds of the world, have really and truly put a lot of trouble on their, quote, own brothers in their own communities. The ones who seem to also suffer that people don't seem to realize are suffering at the hands of these individuals are the Christian Arab community. It's very sad. But Israel also has to face this. And these crises that Israel seems to go through over and over again seem to be something like the spasms we talk about when we say that the world is going through these troubles and as spasms upon a woman when she's about to deliver. But it starts early. You know the expression, maybe you don't know it, but Braxton Hicks is an expression referring to the contractions that a woman has very early on and throughout the term of her pregnancy. Those become severe. They eventually help deliver the child, those contractions. Israel is going through that. They've been going through that. Some were small, some were large. They've gotten larger, and we know there are many troubles ahead. The prophet Jeremiah referred to this regathering process of Israel with the words, it would be a time of travail, a time of trouble, not of peace. And Jeremiah said it very pointedly, it's even the time of Jacob's trouble. That's an interesting expression because as Bible students, we very often not only hear this expression, but usually turn our attention directly toward the expressions of Ezekiel 38 and 39, Gog of Magog is coming, and that's what we leave it at. But I think our subject today will show you, as you'll develop some time looking through the handout with me at different quotations, both from the scriptures and from Brother Russell, that the time of Jacob's trouble, or the day of Jacob's trouble, is the day that we're living in, the day of wrath. And it will have its punctuation, the exclamation point, at Gog of Magog. No question. It's ahead in our understanding of Scripture. When we look at verse 3, which is on your handout, of Jeremiah chapter 30, it says, "For lo, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will bring again the captivity of my people Israel and Judah, saith Jehovah the Lord, and I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it." What a wonderful promise. A heartwarming promise. He is going to cause them to return. We would have to be blind not to see that something is happening since the days when Brother Russell began to study these matters also. In verses 4 to 8, and this is also on your handout, it points out it's not a time of peace, but a time of travail. And these are the words of Jehovah, which he spake concerning Israel and concerning Judah. "For thus saith the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling and of fear concerning Judah. For thus saith the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling and of fear, not of peace. Ask ye now, and see whether a man doth travail with child. Wherefore, why do I see every man with his hands on his loins, as women in travail, and all faces turned to paleness? Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it." How could we better describe the continued crises that have been past and present, but as travail with spasms? Now, Jeremiah, we suggested, describes this regathering, this preparation for what will be the kingdom, their part in it certainly, as a time of trouble, Jacob's trouble. And Bible students have, since the late 1800s, been watching enthusiastically what is happening. Brother Russell not only was watching, but he would write to people like Montefiore. He would write to other individuals like Rothschild, expressing his thoughts. on why they should not take suggestions such as go to Uganda. It's available. When you stand in Petah Tikva and you see the big stone monument for Rothschild with the name Baron Rothschild, 1878, and you realize that was the founding of Petah Tikva because of the activities that were worked on by ones like Disraeli, you realize how important 1878 becomes, not only to us, but to the whole world, and especially to Israel. Getting, so to speak, their feet on the ground where they could say, this is our land. We're back. But it's been painful to watch the decisions that were made by ones like Rabin and others, including the present prime minister, who gave away Hebron. He gave away the city of David to the Palestinian Authority, and now he promises no more of Judea and Samaria, which is the heartland, the places where Jesus walked, the places where the prophets lived. They didn't live in Tel Aviv, you know, they lived in the heartland. And that's what the quote-unquote Palestinians claim for themselves. Little technical detail. What is a Palestinian? Well, it depends on what year you're talking about it. In the 1940s, a Palestinian was a Jew. A Jew. Arabs did not want to be called Palestinians. Those are the Jews. Go read the Palestine Post in the 1930s and 40s. It's written by Jews. They only wanted this after Arafat made it a claim, hold on to this title, we are the Palestinian refugees, let's push it for all it's worth. Now they're Palestinians. But in spite of the conflicts, worldwide and regional, there has been progression, there is a state of Israel, and I am not suggesting that the present government is doing God's will. But they're there. They're there. And as Rabbi Kook, K-O-O-K, very important rabbi of the past, said, even though the people who are in the land are not religious, they are not observant Jews, they are not Orthodox, the fact that they're doing what needs to be done, and that is reestablishing Israel in the land as promised, is extremely important. And I don't want to misquote him, but I think he said they're doing a more righteous deed than those who are Orthodox and doing nothing. That's the sense of what I got out of that lesson. You know, we've watched these troubles. We've watched the way that the leaders are handling things. We've noticed how they've had their conflicts in the nearby states. And we recognize that those people round about may very soon be active in trying to attack Israel. One would think it would be foolish for them to do it. But we also know there are those who are further away. In fact, all people who are prophesied in Zechariah to come up against Israel. So you have these conflicts that are out there potentially facing the people of the land. Were there Jewish people in the land after the big diaspora? The answer is yes. Believe it or not, there were Jews in the land. It wasn't totally evicted. How do we know? If you go to the Jewish Museum, you can see the walls of a synagogue. Walls that were taken down, part of the broken marble that was on the walls of a synagogue in a place called Susia. Some of us have been there, Susia. And that community was destroyed in the 800s when the Arabs came through with their Islamic credos. They do like breaking things, sorry to say, but they've done it, and they can continue to do it if they have the opportunity or will. There's a little village, Pet Gain, in the north hill country of Israel. We drove through there. We saw some people there. At that time, when we went through, there was still a family there who can trace their lineal genealogy in that city from the times when the temple still existed. So there were Jews in the land. When they threw them out of Jerusalem, one rabbi made a deal with the Romans, and he managed to escape safely to go to the north. There are many things that happen that we're not quite familiar with. That does not discount the fact that they put that system out of business, the Romans. They did. There's no question. I'm not questioning that at all. And the type that it portrays. But just think in terms of the fact that Jews were present in the land. And when Winston Churchill drew the line and said, okay, we're giving the land that England is responsible for taking care of, that is on the east side of the Jordan, we're going to give it to the Hashemite family. He robbed the Jewish people of part of their land, about 72% of it. And then what was left was this little piece along the east side, west side of the Jordan, and then they carved that up. And by the time it was all finished, they almost didn't have anything. And they want to go back to those places, those same boundaries. The Obama administration seems to be, and I mean the State Department, which has very, very strong views in this way. They're a very Arabist organization. Why? How many Arab countries are there? How many states of Israel are there? So you have somebody kind of focusing on this place and this place. So as a result, the State Department is filled with many Arabists. When you have just this one little bit, you know. And also there's anti-Semitism that has plagued the children of Israel for centuries and decades and years and so forth, and even hours, working backwards in our minds. Let's move forward. Examining the context of Jeremiah 30, verse 7, gives us the suggestion that we may want to think of this discourse as Jacob's trouble in context, because that's what we're going to try to look at. And it's assuring to us and comforting to us that the Lord, in his laying out of this subject in Jeremiah 30 through the prophet's mouth, was telling us something that we might not have caught on if it weren't for the fact that we understand the divine plan. Birth is not an instantaneous moment. It's a process. And the travail of trouble for Israel is a process. When Jeremiah 30 says that, and that it is so great, it's none like it, we should be hearing the language of two other places in the Bible, not just Jeremiah 30. What two places? What two places in the Bible say almost the same language as it is the day is great so that none is like it? Do you hear Daniel 12? Time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation? Do you hear the next place coming ringing in your head? And it's in what book? Matthew 24, and exactly. So now you have Jeremiah 30, you have Daniel 12, and you have Matthew 20, talking about the day of the Lord, time of trouble such as never was. None's like it. If it none's like it, it's like never was, right? Okay, so this is what we see. As we think of Daniel and we think of Matthew, let's start thinking of the context of Jeremiah 30 in the same way. It's a time of trouble. The day we're living in, the day of God's wrath. And they have had their share of trouble during this time. But what's been happening out of that trouble? They are being saved out of it. We're suggesting, therefore, that if anything, Gog of Magog is the punctuation, the climax, not the whole. And we hope to be able to show you that that was also Brother Russell's language thought on the same subject. Looking back at your handout, we're going to just have a few scriptures to give some background, very light background on the subject of how did Israel get in this predicament that it's in now. Well, we know that the good Lord, in his speaking with Moses and the children of Israel, lined up a specific pattern for them to live by. Remember, they came into the land and they were supposed to read the blessings on Mount Gerizim and then the curses. So these blessings and curses, if you do this, I'm going to bless you. If you do this, you're going to get spanked. And we also know that there was a time of favor with punishment, or punishment with favor. And there was a time when the punishment would come, but there would be no favor. We talk about the Jewish double. Remember these points, right? Okay, so here's what it is. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes, Leviticus 18, and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, that the land spew you He says, spew not you out also. When ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. Think of the significance of these words. The Lord told them in advance, the nations that you are replacing, the Lord has arranged that the land will spit them out of the land. That will happen to you if you don't follow the law of God. Jeremiah 16. This is a part that fits into the double. At first, I will recompense their iniquity and their sin double because they have defiled my land. This is on your handout. Amos wrote, I will sift the house of Israel among the nations as corn in a sieve or grain in a sieve. Okay? Just picture somebody sifting grain, all right? Yet not the least grain shall fall upon the earth, Amos 9:9. And now note here that the Lord has not going to lose track of them. He's not going to lose, and he's not going to forget them. I think this is very important. Through all the turmoil of the time that has been the time of the punishment without favor, he still is not going to forget them. He still is not going to abandon or ignore them. So when 1878 comes and the double of punishment without favor is ended, 1845 years, they're allowed to again have access to their own land. Now, there are some technicalities here. We talk about the Berlin Congress of Nations. And the Berlin Congress of Nations, 1878, has something going on just before it where the British government, anxious to get their fingers on what is now the Holy Land, Israel, managed to work a deal with the Turkish government to allow others than Muslims to own land. Guess who the others were they were interested in? England. I mean, come on. England never could be accused of a lack of appreciation for other people's land. That's not an original quote, by the way. Think back in history, you'll see. But now, the Cyprus Accords, the arrangement that was made to give England some power and some control over this area, benefited the Jews. Because now they could do, they're not Muslim, they're not Christian, but it just says, others than Muslims could own land. So now, a group of Jews from Jerusalem go to Petah Tikva, which wasn't Petah Tikva, they set up this community, and they call it Petah Tikva. Why? Because they wanted to encourage others to come. It was the door. What door? What door? The door of hope. Exactly. But Jehovah, you might say, would have called it an engagement ring. Hence the picture on your paper. He said, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably to her, and I will give her her vineyards from from thence, and the valley of Achor. For what reason? For a Petah Tikva, a gate or a door of hope. That was very prescient in the minds of those individuals. Thinking ahead, planning ahead, carefully thinking about what will come beyond what they could do. You know, interesting little detail. Sadly enough, that little community didn't make out too well. But it was the door. And it did come to pass. And by 1912, they had a thriving community there. But they started this whole process in 1878. And hence, that monument to Rothschild, who funded this. On your handout, remember these, O Jacob. This is from Isaiah 44. O Israel, thou shalt not be forgotten of me. I have blotted out as a thick cloud thy transgressions, and as a cloud thy sins. Return unto me, for I have redeemed thee. There's the call. He's still pleading in the wilderness of the people, as you know from Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 35. He is going to rule over them. They're going to be brought back. They're going to be helped. Joel 3:7. I will raise them out of the place whither ye, the Gentiles, have sold them. Ezekiel 37, I will open your graves and bring you to the land of Israel. Didn't occur to me that when you give a funeral discourse, one of the best ways to encourage the people who are there is to tell them, have you ever seen a resurrection? And ask them if they realize that God promised to bring Israel out of the grave. And every time you hear the name Israel, you know that God's promises come true. So where are they going to return to? On your handout, they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. I will plant them upon their land. They shall no more be pulled up out of their land, which I have given them, saith the Lord Jehovah, thy God. You know, it's at times you kind of wonder, how are they going to ever survive? At times you say to yourself, can they really do this? Can they really survive these attacks, these potential dangers? Hezbollah with thousands of rockets, Hamas with rockets, Iran with military ships off the coast of Israel. It's not so far being off the coast of Israel. Coming up through the Suez Canal, going in these various places with their warships. You wonder, how could they possibly? You have to read it with faith. It's the only way. I, Jehovah, will plant them in this land assuredly with my whole heart and with my whole soul. Jeremiah 32:41. Jeremiah presents a description of the day of returning is not of peace, but is a time of trouble, a travail of trouble. That's what we need to think about. You know, the Apostle Paul reminds us about the day of the Lord. He also compares it to a travail. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 2 and 3. We'll read it from your handout. The day of the Lord, when they shall say peace and safety, sudden destruction shall come upon them as travail upon a woman with child. We all acknowledge that that's the day of God's wrath. That's the day of the Lord. That's the time when Matthew wrote about when Jesus spoke it. That's the time when Daniel wrote about it, when he was told to put this down on paper. Daniel is a very special individual. Daniel got to tell us when Christ's first advent would be, and he also got to punctuate it by telling us when the second advent would be. Very special. Daniel chapter 9 lays out the 70-week prophecy. Daniel 12 gives us the 1335 days. And when you read the last verses of Daniel 12, you realize it even promises his resurrection. You will stand. You will stand. Not now, later. Okay, so if you have some Jewish people who are wondering about resurrection, let them read about Daniel. Jeremiah, Daniel, and Jesus all spoke of the same matter. Israel and the great trouble. The difference between the travail on the old order before the kingdom is established is that the old order is dying. But Israel is being resurrected, delivered. Jacob will be saved out of it. So in answer to a question that came to me this morning, do you know anybody who's not dying? I guess I could say the scriptures are saying Israel's now coming back to life. That's not quite the question, but close. Volume 4. Let's take a look at Volume 4. This is extremely important in my head on this subject because it is in Volume 4, in the Battle of the Great Day, written in 1897 that Brother Russell discussed what he called the final blast, which would come upon the regathered people of Israel under the subtopic, you guessed it, the time of Jacob's trouble. Unquestionably, he links Jacob's trouble to the invasion of Gog of Magog, when the nations come against the unwalled villages, even against Jerusalem. However, there's always a however, isn't there? Now, what's the however? On your handout, and I think I'm going to look at my handout with you, because if I don't, I'll wander into my notes too deeply. You can see a listing of seven items. Let's look at the first one. He says, and notice that what this is. This is written in 1897. Poor Jews. Much of Jacob's trouble lies ahead before the faithful are gathered back to Palestine. At that time, that's what it was called, very appropriately. We can talk about that subject later, but notice the point. The very same year that Volume 4 was printed, 1897, he says, Gog of Magog, but he's also saying, it's not finished. So he has a sense in which it's not finished. Let's go to the next year. In reprint 2290, the very next year, 1898, an introduction to the words of the editor of Jewish World, he writes, very evidently the time of Jacob's trouble is not yet ended. Probably still greater persecutions will shortly overtake them to drive them to Palestine and thus fulfill the Lord's predictions through the prophets. Noting this proximity of time, we have to ask ourselves, why is he saying these two different things? Well, evidently he sees this larger Day of the Lord period, but he also sees the climax. And he's focusing in on the climax because he expects the climax by what year? 1914, no question. The ultimate climax. And the church to go home as well. Remember, that's part of the package of 1914. He expected the church to go home as much as he did in 1878 and 1881 and so forth. Okay. We're up to the third one. In every nation of Europe, this is 1901, except Great Britain, Jews have suffered persecution. And then I'm going to read the bold print. And the time of Jacob's trouble is to last up to the very close of the day of vengeance. That's our day of the Lord, the day of God's wrath, when they shall be delivered by the setting up of the kingdom. Interesting. The pattern is here. Year after year, he's saying basically the same thing. In 1902, Jewish woes in Romania. It is the time of Jacob's trouble. The poor Jews are subject to tribulation in one country after another. So-called Christians who are ignorant of real Christianity. Now it is Romania that persecutes. Notice I didn't say the Romanian brethren. I said Romania. But now, perhaps at the close of this little portion, we have this number 1910 one. Our hearts are in sympathy with the Jewish people. They have been nationally left desolate 18 centuries. We especially rejoice to think that the time of Jacob's trouble will soon be over. You know, I think we all rejoice that the time of trouble for the whole world will soon be over. But we realize there's still pain ahead, don't we? And we wish we could help it end sooner. But the Lord knows better what time is supposed to be happening. Now, this last one, I pulled it out of context in terms of time. It's one actually preceded the final, the writing of Volume 4. It occurred in 1895. The reason I saved it for last is because this was written in 1895, in reprint 1898, and these numbers are going to get confusing if we don't think about them. 1898 reprint, written in 1895, calling attention in this article that he wrote to the Council of Vienna. The Council of Vienna had just appointed a rabid Jew hater, an anti-Semite, as the mayor. And as if Brother Russell could see the future, he writes, yes, we are in the time of Jacob's trouble, and we shall not be surprised if bitterness against the race shall reach an intensity to expel them from Austria, Germany, France, Spain, Portugal. How'd you like to write the news 40 years in advance? 40 years after this was written, the Nuremberg Laws were passed. Do you know what the Nuremberg Laws were? It distinguished between all Jews. They could not marry, they could not have businesses, they could not, as doctors, treat non-Jews, etc., etc., etc. And the persecution got worse, as you know, over the next 10 years. He wrote this. 1895. Under the concept that it's the time of Jacob's trouble. Notice, not just Gog of Magog. As if I had to remind you of that, right, by now. So Jeremiah expected the travail for Israel's regathering. So while we understand that the emphasis was on the climax for 1914, we also can appreciate this wider understanding. Well, it's time to go back to Jeremiah 30 and take a look at verses 9 and 10. It's on your handout. And this is just to show us that really there's a focal point in this chapter. And that focal point has to do with Messiah and the Messianic kingdom. But they shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them. Therefore fear thou not. And I'm skipping a little. I will save thee from afar and thy seed from the land of their captivity, and Jacob shall return and be at rest, and none shall make him afraid. Well, we haven't gotten there yet, have we? Not with saber rattling out of Iran and other places. This promised restoration was foremost on the hearts of the apostles also. And what were they hoping for? Well, now picture. Did they know the words of Isaiah 35 that you always like to tell people about when you witness? The ransomed of the Lord will return, the lame shall walk, and so forth. The lame shall be able to walk, they'll run like deer. The blind shall see, the deaf shall hear. When Jesus was asked to teach them to pray, he taught them what our Catholic friends call the Our Father. And if you're ever witness to a Catholic, tell them that that's a very important prayer to pray. Not that they should count it out on their rosary, but very important. Why? He told them to pray, thy kingdom come. What kingdom? The one Isaiah just told us about. They knew this. So at the ascension, at the moment, you could say, that Jesus was about to leave them, they ask him a question. Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And you know what he didn't say? Are you kidding? They just crucified me. Why would I do that? What a preposterous question. He didn't say that. He said, that's in the Father's time. That's not for you to know. What does that imply? That it's not going to happen? Of course it's going to happen. They knew it. They expected something different. But in fact, it would happen. If we go further, in verse 11, we see that there are promises that are made. Here's one, for I am with thee, saith Jehovah, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. Verse 12, for thus saith Jehovah, thy bruise is incurable, thy wound is grievous. All thy lovers have forgotten thee, they seek thee not, for I have wounded thee with the wound of an enemy, with the chastisement of a cruel one, for the multitude of thine iniquity. Because thy sins were increased. Now, we want to remember that. I want to come back to that. Why criest thou for thine affliction? Thy sorrow is incurable, for the multitude of thy iniquity, because thy sins were increased, I have done these things unto thee. This deserves a little bit of attention, but how to pull it apart and make sense out of it? This is not so easy. We can suggest something. What possible other sins might there be even after they have been told, as in Isaiah 40, comfort ye my people, your iniquity is pardoned. Is there more sin after that? Well, two things that we can think of that might be considered sin by Jehovah after the Jewish double would be not going back to the land. And that brought a lot of grief on a lot of heads. And two, playing up to all the lovers, trying to placate them instead of throwing their complete trust in Jehovah. Go not down to Egypt. Well, they've been going down to Egypt. Will they get trouble? Yeah. Do they? You know, I have to tell you, I had two occasions where I brought the subject of, you know, I said to these two Jewish people, one was a young student who was at my school where I was teaching, presenting on behalf of Israel, and one was the minister of, he was in the ministry. He was from South Africa, but he became an Israeli government personage in the government. Two different people. First one, I said to the young boy, I said, there's a promise in the Bible that the east side of the Jordan River is really supposed to be Israel. Don't say that. Why? Because that'll only mean we have to fight. We don't want to fight. We don't want to kill anybody. But you see, it's in the scriptures. Now, that tells us something else. It tells us that these kids are not. This is a kid who was going to be a jet pilot. They weren't anxious to go and grab land. A lot of what they wound up getting was the result of it being pushed upon them. It's something to remember when the world tells you they're aggressive. They're aggressive, all right, but not because they want to be. Second one, the government official, he says, yes, I know those scriptures. But let's not go there. Because, again, it brings up this unfortunate problem of, and it's about the land of Gilead. You'll find it in Zechariah 10:10. It's a very sad thing to think that people will have to go and suffer and or hurt in order for these things to take place. But we remember how David took the city of Jerusalem in the first place, and what the Lord told the children of Israel to do to go into the land in the first place and to deal with it. Okay, that's just a suggestion. As far as the chastisement of the cruel one, let's talk a little bit more about the angry business. In Zechariah, it says, Zechariah 1:14-15, that God was angry with Israel. And he prepared certain chastisements. But it's almost like when he allowed the nations to hurt Israel, they couldn't resist overdoing it. And Zechariah says, while I was only a little angry, they, the Gentiles, furthered the affliction. So, yes, he has allowed them to suffer, but the Gentiles kind of run with it and cause much more grief. In return, read the first part of the verse, I was exceedingly jealous for Jerusalem and Zion, but I am very angry with the nations because they furthered the affliction. So, you want to hurt my people and my land? Yeah, I'm going to let you. But if you overdo it, I'm going to give you a shellacking, as they say. My father used to use that word. You wonder why. But truly, there have been punishments that have come permitted of the Lord. And that's what I think might have happened with this expression about the chastisement of a cruel one. I can't pin that to the Holocaust or to Hitler or anybody like that. But, you know, the Lord allowed it, and sadly enough, there were people in this world who, as with, let's say, the Gog of Magog experience, just look and say, why are you doing that? Why are you hurting Israel? and not doing anything to stop them. There's a lot of history that goes into that discussion about why places like the Europeans and the United States did not provide any refuge for Jewish people. Some of it had to do with anti-Semitism, some of it had to do with economics, some of it had to do with war policy and trying to prevent people from the Germans having too many advantages over the Europeans and the United States by destroying the rail lines that would have allowed people to be taken to the gas chambers. Somehow I think Satan would have managed to kill the Jews one way or another, whatever the United States did, but I don't think that excuses their lack of cooperation. Okay. Today, even though Netanyahu is playing a very careful game to get reelected and to have his political allies get elected, would not surprise me if things work out a little different than he hopes, or that he's got a second game plan where he will bond himself together with the liberals again to the benefit of his own interests and maybe the placating of other world powers. But to give up Judea and Samaria, in the words of one of the rabbis back when Netanyahu gave up Hebron, which is Hebron, you don't spit back in the face of Jehovah or God, the Hashem, as they say, what he has given you. He's given you Hebron, you don't throw it back in his face. And that's what was said after Netanyahu gave back Hebron. I suspect more will happen like that. Even his associate partner in politics, this Mr. Avigdor Lieberman, who was very strong, evidently has a cloud hanging over him. And to manage himself through the political fray within the country, he has had to state publicly that he could see a two-state solution. There already is a Palestinian state. Do you know where it is? East Jordan. East of Jordan. It's called the Country of Jordan. Rebecca wrote a document for our trip once. She referred to Jordan as East Israel. It's true. Now, I don't know how much of it, but certainly when Jesus was in the area where John the Baptist had been, that's east of the Jordan. It's East Israel. Okay. Has anyone ever touched your eye physically, besides a doctor? You know what Jehovah said? Surely he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of my Jehovah's eye. This is a remarkable statement because you don't just walk up and poke your finger in someone's eye, and that's what Jehovah is saying. Don't you do that. Jeremiah 30, verse 16. Therefore all they that devour thee shall be devoured. And all at the end of the document. Excuse me. Pardon me. All they that prey upon thee will I give for a prey. I'd like to think it's something that doesn't have to happen, but it happens. Sneezing. The prophet Joel explains in Israel's experience from Joel 3, 2, 4, 9, 12, 16, 13. I will gather all nations. I will bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Then I will enter into my judgment with them on behalf of my people and mine inheritance, whom they have scattered among the nations, and have divided up my land. I return your recompense upon your own head. Proclaim this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. There's a couple of things that need to be said about this. One of them is we have to read 2 Chronicles 20 to get the full story of what happened in the Valley of Jehoshaphat before, why it's called that. And secondly, the words proclaim among the Gentiles to prepare war. The words literally mean sanctify war. It's almost as if it's saying the Gentiles will have a holy war against God. Can you picture that? A holy war against Jehovah. But in 2 Chronicles, if you know the story, you'll just think this is just a brief review of it. But Jehoshaphat was a considerably good king. He had some mistakes, of course, as most of us all do. He gets the message that down in the Valley Kidron, which goes down toward the Dead Sea, there's armies accumulating. And those armies are going to come up the valley and attack Jerusalem. And he is horrified. He presents the matter to Jehovah, and Jehovah, through a Levite, tells him what to do. It's a very simple process. He says, prepare for the battle, but don't expect to fight. Oh, all right. So Jehoshaphat explains this to the people. The people prepare for the battle, and then they go down into the valley singing. They have singers in front of them, leading them down into the valley. This is a war. What do they find when they get down there? Everybody's dead. Everybody's dead. How come? Well, it so happens that two go against one, and then those two go against each other, and they kill each other. And all that's left is all the loot. Swords, shields, all kinds of things that you could have a bazaar, you know, have a flea market or whatever with what's left. But no one alive. How did that happen? The Lord set ambushes. The Lord created an environment where these people fell on each other and it was all over. Is that what the Lord has in mind for the future attacks on Israel? We would not be surprised. Because in times that are ahead of us, we recognize that there'll be a time when the ancient worthies are on the scene. There'll be wisdom in their lips for the world, the Israelites to follow. And when they're attacked, they will be given just the right information. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. You know, listening to me, I suppose you could probably say, boy, he likes war. No, I don't like war. I don't like killing. But apparently some people don't stop until they're stopped. And the Lord knows how to do that best. So when they are upset enough about what's going on, as they did in the days of Samuel the prophet, as they did in the days of the other prophets or judges, they finally go to the Lord and they're very sorry. They reform their minds. And then something happens that the prophet rises up or the judge rises up and they deal with them as they did with Barak and Deborah, with Samuel, and so forth. And with the ancient worthies on the scene, guided by the church and Jesus, things will be done efficiently and expeditiously without unnecessary pain. And then comes Jeremiah 30:17-22, for I will restore unto thee health. I will heal thee of thy wounds. I will bring again the captivity of the tents of Jacob and have mercy on his dwelling places, and the city shall be builded on her own heap. Now that's the word tell. And a tell, of course, is a place where city after city had existed and fallen down, and they rebuilt it, and it looks like a big pile of dirt. Well, that's what it is. And the palace shall remain after that, and ye shall be my people, I'll be your God. All of this is promised. So those mounds that they used to see in Israel, which they're now sometimes taking apart and excavating, were actually old cities. Samaria was like that. We saw the pile of dirt there. Lachish was like that. We saw that pile. And Jerusalem has its levels, and Megiddo, and so forth. And the Lord knows in advance that the old city would be rebuilt on its own heap, its own place. And we see that happening. If you've climbed in and out of the places that are in Jerusalem, I went down over the little barriers and stuff like that, down into a pile of rock that was a wall. That wall is dated from the days of Jeremiah. It was a very unique experience because you can see it looking down into a hole through a glass window underneath what is called the Cardo in Jerusalem. But you can go down the steps and look at it really close. I couldn't resist going down and climbing out and touching this wall. Shouldn't do those things. Two verses more. Behold, the tempest of the Lord. Wrath has gone forth. This is what's going to happen to those who come against his people and his land. The fierce anger of the Lord will not turn back until he hath performed, until he hath accomplished the intent of his heart. In the latter days, you will understand this. This is the climax, Gog of Magog. Let's go to Ezekiel 37, 38, and 39 in sequence. In 37, what's happening? A shaking, the gathering of dry bones. In 38, the invasion of Gog of Magog. I will call for a sword. I will rain upon him and his bands great hailstones, fire and brimstone. This is incredible language. It reminds us of the days of the judges and Joshua. It reminds us of what's in Revelation 16 during the seventh of the seven last plagues. In the latter days, and this is in 38 also, I will be sanctified in thee. Here's a very unique thing. Gog of Magog is going to come against the children of Israel. And Jehovah says, I'm going to be sanctified in you, Gog. Now, how's that possible? In other words, what happens will actually turn out to honor Jehovah. He will be realized as being truly holy. And all the governments of earth and all the peoples and the nations will come up against Jerusalem. They will go to fight against Israel. And finally, in the last analysis, they will come up to be blessed by Israel. What a reversal. They go up to fight, to kill, and they wind up having to go there for blessings. Remarkable. Zechariah 8:13. As ye, Israel, have been a curse among the nations, they will be a blessing. Why is it important for us to have this understanding? It presents to us a picture, presents to us an understanding of how the Lord God not only planned this, knew this, yet allowing man's free will, such as the abuse by the Gentiles against Israel, furthering the affliction, allowed all this to take place, and yet planned the regathering and the re-sanctifying of his people and his land and himself. It should be a comfort to us to know that the Lord had this laid out. And also that Brother Russell saw quite clearly this two perspective. The gradual period of the day of wrath, Jeremiah, Daniel, Matthew 12 and Matthew 24. This is the picture of trouble at the end of the age, out of which Israel comes and prospers, the nations of the world are in demise. We should know from this that we're not living in a happenstance world. Things are not just happening accidentally. They are providentially arranged with free will allowed, but providentially guided. Jeremiah assures us that that day is the time of Jacob's trouble, but he will be saved out of it. And in spite of the failure of the Israeli governments to do anything right much of the time. There is, brethren, a group of Orthodox Jews, many of them living in Judea and Samaria, who have intense faith that they are there to bless the world. If you were to listen to the people on what is Aretz Sheva, that's called Channel 7. You know, Channel 7 is Aretz Sheva in Hebrew. These people use the expression, we are to be a light to the Gentiles. They really believe this. They don't see Messiah. But what else is new? Who does? Name a nation that's truly Christ-oriented. Name a people that is Christ-oriented. So they don't understand either. These are people who would say, we believe fully in the prayer of Psalm 83, where it's a prayer, Lord, they want to destroy us, do this to them, make them like tumbleweeds blowing in the wind. I think out here you know what tumbleweeds are, right? Well, the prayer is about like making them like tumbleweeds. Doesn't say burn them in hell forever. Of course not. But it says make them like tumbleweeds. But then they also believe in Isaiah 62. Now, you and I believe in Isaiah, 52. What is Isaiah 52? Key scripture. How beautiful on the mountain are the feet of him that publisheth glad tidings, tidings of peace, and to publish what? Thy God reigneth. Ten chapters later, Isaiah 62, I will not hold my peace until Jerusalem is a praise in the earth. They preach this. They preach it. They are aware of what this says. And I'm very thankful for that, because I know Brother Russell believed that the Orthodox would take this position. He just didn't see that in the meanwhile, between his day and the day when you have Orthodox living there preaching these things, that there would be a lot of secular people doing the grunt work, you could say, to get the nation together. For Zion's sake, I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not rest. If we can say, as watchmen, from Isaiah 52, thy God reigneth, should we not also say, for Zion's sake, in Isaiah 62, I will not hold my peace? Where it says in verse 6, I have set watchmen on thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace day or night, that ye may make mention of the Lord. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silent. Give him no rest until he establish and until he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. Think about how many times you have prayed, thy kingdom come. Could you count them? This is what will happen when thy kingdom come is fulfilled. Maybe also you could include the words that Jerusalem should be a praise in the earth. Because it will. And you could be a prayer partner on that level as well. With the Lord's help, we will be thought of, hopefully, someday as the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Because it's this opportunity that you and I have, knowing about the will of the Lord, that gives us the ability not only to share the restitution promises and blessings, but remember that when the disciples said, will you at this time restore, to restore, verb, the kingdom to Israel, it's the same word that you find in the third chapter when Peter is speaking, and he's talking about the noun form of that same word, the times of restitution. Same thing. May the Lord add his blessing.